Hey everyone, I'm Matt, and this is
Andy,
and you're listening to episode 5 of Backjack, the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast. Today we'll be discussing the third episode of Samurai Jack, entitled The First Fight.
Watcha! I had to throw that in there, because I love when they say that in the show. So this sounds like it's like the end of a trilogy, maybe? It's the end of the third, air quotes, episode. But it actually can be watched as one big long movie, the same way that Birth of Evil could be, which is why we did that. Again, one of the other reasons we did that one first. So going into this episode, I'm sure we have a very nice, precise summary written.
Yeah, here we go. Samurai Jack and the pack prepare to repel a massive column of sickle-wielding beetle drones sent by Aku. They will make use of every dog stereotype-based construction vehicle at their disposal. But can one samurai really stand against an entire mechanized fighting force alone?
Let's find out. Because I think that if the crystal punjis and the rocket engines and the landslides and the amazing sword work have anything to say about it, I think Jack will win. But that's just a guess. I'm just guessing here. So perhaps we can just go through the episode and find out.
Oh, yes.
Sounds good.
So
we open on
Jack begins planning the old-fashioned way with a map. I noticed it was a little odd that the archaeologists didn't already have a map of the area. You know, it's their dig site. Point.
That's true, babe. They should have had it gridded out. I mean, that's how humans do it. Like, we would have had a grid of things. It could have just been, like any dog, they were digging someplace interesting. They just sniffed around until they found someone. Oh, I say, this smells interesting. Let's dig here. And they brought the little doggy digger over. The doggy tank digger.
Yeah, the weird double-armed caterpillar digger.
Interesting to see what dogs might conceptualize as technologically feasible. If they were, you know, indeed super intelligent, rich Rothschilds, wiener dogs with pith helmets. But yeah, there's this great thing where they're looking through macro binoculars to, you know, remind the audience when they come back from break.
Oh yeah.
Oh, here's the impending threat. Here's the enemies closing in on us. And what are we going to do? How are we going to fight back against this? Oh, geez, we don't have any weapons as such, except for the samurai. Now what? But thousands of years in the future, they still have a basic click ballpoint pen. Like some tech is just so classic, it never goes away. Magic swords? Yeah, sure. Dance clubs? Absolutely. Ballpoint click pens? Fuck yeah.
Oh, yeah. I also wanted to point out, in the last two episodes, we've really seen a recurring theme of the person who warns everyone that there's something coming is this guy who's like, oh, hey, guys.
The enemy's coming up right over there, guys.
Yeah.
Some things I think they've thrown in just because it's a kid's cartoon and it's just simply funny. Like, let's just draw a little doodle of a dog with a funny voice and have our voice actor give us 5 different takes of a goofy voice. And yeah, we'll just like throw that in. We just need to communicate to the audience. We just need to tell the audience this little bit of information to affirm what they think they saw. Because remember, this is everything about the series is all storyboarding. It's all, let's tell the story as visually as we possibly can. So they don't spend a lot of time talking about the lead up to it. They show him laying out the map. They show him precisely drawing stuff. And this is the cool thing. Jack makes a plan exactly like his father said to do. We have to have a plan. And he probably had that drilled into his head. You must have a plan. If you have an intractable enemy closing in, here's how you deal with it. Here's part of his training. I'm thinking it was probably the Shaolin monks who had the best chance of teaching him actual tactics. Everybody else was teaching him personal combat skills. Yep. They were teaching him how to run, how to fight, how to shoot, how to ride and shoot, how to wrestle, and how to use a sword. But I'm pretty sure the monks had some sort of Sun Tzu analog, where they might have taught him, when you are outnumbered 2-1, you must attack. Always make sure this is good ground and that the enemy is inhibited in all forms by the ground that you're trying to, always force them to fight on your terms. You know, all these great Sun Tzu tactics that he put into play right here.
We see him later, use a whole lot of Shaolin techniques, which would mean that he had to have been there for quite some time.
I'm thinking it was probably the largest part of his training.
Yeah, it would be easy to assume that he's definitely had a lot of practice working on tactics, because we've seen over the course of actual history, although granted, this is some kind of weird alternate timeline. Over the course of history, monks have gotten involved in wars again and again. So there's no doubt that they do have a pretty good knowledge, even if he didn't speak to any actual Sun Tzu analogs, which there's also a good chance he's done that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they had Robin Hood. They had right. The Egyptians. I'm sure a major analog of Sun Tzu was in there somewhere. It wasn't
some kind of brilliant military strategist some kind.
And he would have studied that the way he studied the scrolls in Egypt. That would have been part of his education.
Yeah, one of the things we see later is he intuits well about his opponent without knowing anything about them, which I think was, it could have actually been a little bit of luck. Hmm. But we'll talk about that when we get to that part of the episode. But
okay.
Yep, he goes through his plan. You know, we see him directing everyone, pointing to different parts of the map and everything.
Yeah.
Everyone wags their tail in approval.
That was cute. That was just like, does the circle agree? Wag, 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 wag. That was great. And they have this great, awesome 80s A-Team montage music playing.
Yep.
Dun, 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 dun. Like when they were, you probably don't remember the A-Team. It was one of the first TV shows that really brought that cinematic montage to the TV.
I'm pretty sure everyone has heard of the A-Team.
You know, they'll weld shit to a dozer, and then they'll put like a harvester combine thing on it to crush the mobster's car, and their van, of course, they'll cut a hole in the top and put a 50 caliber on it. Like, the A-Team was always clutching stuff together, and it was kind of a nifty little, oh yeah, if anybody here is old enough to remember the A-Team, remember this? And it showed them all, dun, yep. dun, 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 and they're like, you know, setting up all these wonderful traps. They're using everything at their disposal in ways that it was never designed to be used as, but yeah. Jack understands at the very least forces. He understands, oh, the diggers are pulling against the earth. They're very powerful, retracting. So I understand kinesthetics. I understand how bodies move. So if I turn them upside down, instead of pulling, they can throw. So if I turn them upside down, which the dogs wouldn't have thought about doing, because being upside down means rub my belly. And for a human, it's nope, that means I can lay here and throw things. So, you know, there are certain conceits that he has as a being who evolved with hands that the dogs might not instinctively think about.
Absolutely. Just look at the way he employed the crystals.
Yeah, the dogs would never bury something sharp that would hurt you. No, we bury things in order to save them. You know, like maybe that's another thing. Maybe the dogs that were the final ones out of the city deliberately buried some of their favorite things in the city.
Like the hydrant.
Right, exactly. That would make perfect sense that any dogs leaving the city going, you know, let this be our final legacy. Let's bury the hydrant in the backyard. And they just like scoop the dirt over the top because it's precious to them and they don't want it to get, they want to save it for later. And, you know, but he's doing everything for them. He's setting up the rocket engines. He said he's bolting armor on the horse, and that horse was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
That horse was amazing.
And we also noticed there's sort of a comparison being made. And it's hard to say whether or not they even had it planned for it to be sort of mirrored, considering how far back this episode is compared to Birth of Evil. But there's a very easy comparison between the Emperor and Jack, you know, riding in on a multi-legged horse, you know.
Yeah.
And
Sleipnir?
Part of that is Sleipnir. We also see Jack make a sashimono, or a Japanese-like banner.
Oh, the back banner thing? It, like, sticks like a flag straight up on their back, and it's like a long flag thing.
He puts the kamon on it. He puts the family crest on it. And then we see the dogs walk over it and leave dog prints, and he actually goes with it. And I think one thing people should know about sashimono, when you make a banner like this, it's partly about pride, but it's functional. It's extremely functional. All the other soldiers from your clan can see that's an ally. From a long distance, they could say, that's my team. My team is advanced this far ahead in the battlefield over there across the hill.
And you know where to rally to. I mean, they did that in Europe, too, with certain banners and things. But I think having more of those guys running around means there's multiple rally points. And it keeps your, it keeps your little knots of soldiers, your little platoons, when they re-rally to make another push, you can rally smaller groups of them together, which makes them more mobile and more useful than, oh, let's just rally all of the cavalry. Let's have all of the footmen. No, these are like, okay, Clan Collins, you're going to be over here. Clan Igle, you'll be over here. And we're going to rally them to each of your sons. And each of your sons will have a banner. And each of them will be pulling up different parts and supporting different groups. So the combat was probably smaller, but also more ritualistic and probably just as deadly, but not quite as barbaric as European combat at the time probably paralleled it.
Like, I mean, look,
it seemed to be a bit more elegant the way they went about it.
Man, back then, really, what really happened on the battlefield, what a lot of samurai took home with them, was that it was barbaric. That at the end of the day, hey, we went out there and took every head we could get because it was the only way to earn money. It was the only way to earn land. It was the only way to take the lifestyle of a samurai and make something for your family, if you even have one. Or maybe make it possible for you to ever have a family, get somewhere, you know, achieve something. And part of that was taking heads. So there, and you're on the battlefield.
Brutal.
And there's other soldiers on your team around. You have to get the heads, the good heads first. Really, though. I mean, they wanted to take the generals, you know?
It's head harvesting time.
And that's really what was going on a lot of the time. So,
and dogs don't think that way. Not at all.
So you have to keep in mind, like, when it comes to the banners, they're meant for team tactics. That's what's really going on with one of those. And Jack is making a Sashimono without that in mind. There's not going to be a team with him. So what is he making it for? It's because in the prior episode, we saw him look at the dogs like they were his family.
Yeah, he had that moment.
Like his family back home.
Mm-hmm.
All of this is part of this. He's almost acting out what happened, but this time I'm going to do it right.
Because his family, he's seeing the dogs as a surrogate.
Right.
Their whole situation is a surrogate for us. Even Rothschild, who might be considered a noble.
Right.
Because he's rich and has a rich accent. The dude doing the accent was very clearly attempting to mimic the, you know, the great British explorers that went into darkest Africa to bring out the most barbaric things we found. And look at this tusk. And, you know, they're trying to bring out that Hollywood shorthand, you know, for it. But he was still seeing these guys, these dogs sitting around as learned individuals. These people were like the people he trained with in a certain way. They were archaeologists. They dug up the past. They literally, and dogs digging things up. I mean, like, haha, that's
and more importantly, Aku was still using the same torture.
Mm-hmm.
After all these thousands of years, he was still doing the same exact things to these dogs that they were doing to his family.
Yeah, it worked.
And so here we go. We see him. He puts his kamon on the banner and
the dog paw prints are on it. Like, they're my clan now. Like,
right.
They're the people I'm defending. And they're not going to rally to me. They just need to see me.
Yep.
This is pro forma. This is a ritual. This is what I learned. This is how it's done. Capital T, capital H, capital I, capital D. This is how it's done. You put on armor made of a cook pot. And, you know, being that he's the only one there that was really competent in wearing it, you know, he put on put a shovel on the horse's face and mm-hmm. just like, that's an awesome thought. Of course it would fit. Like, the horse's head was curved. They never would have thought of that.
By the way, anyone who wants to do a comparison, when I look at that horse dinosaur thing, I see a six-legged Amargasaurus. So if you want
shovel-headed hexahorse,
go ahead and go ahead and look that up just to see. A lot of early conceptions of the Amargasaurus had this sail on their back when it was probably something closer to more like a hump on a camel. It was probably holding, you know, either very large muscles or, you know, water retention. It could be in any number of things, but probably not a sail. But it's early, at least, you know, when we first found it, we were depicting it as a sail. And really, this horse thing reminds me a lot of that. It's got this, like, very sauropod sort of theme going on.
On the back of it. Yeah, it's clearly not of Earth. Like, it's still organic.
Yeah, and it has compound eyes.
The dogs are using organics. They're not using a lot of, I mean, their mechanical things are under their control.
Yes.
We don't see dog robots. We only see machines the dogs operate.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're either that's more primitive. They were the cheapest for Rothschild to buy, or they just don't like that. I'm thinking that there's probably, you know, some sort of negative connotation to those who teleoperate or inhabit robot bodies here. Like we saw
or
a lot
cyborg
of
cyborg bodies or what have
or
you.
Or cyborg bodies, yeah. But the dogs were pretty much organic, and the things they used were controlled by, were made to be controlled by organic beings. So they had levers and buttons and things that could be moved. And the coolest part about this whole setup is we also see Jack using a lot of the other training that we talked about. So he's learning how to do tactics. He's making this crystal punji pit. He's making arrows with this crystal. Well, they still haven't explained what this crystal is, where it comes from. Is it a power source? Can it be charged? It's obviously incredibly hard, but somewhat brittle. And it's not terribly heavy. They could use all of their things to make a gigantic crystal punji pit to stop some of the bugs with. Again, slow them down. You know, all of these tactics are designed to frustrate the bugs' advance and mm-hmm. to peel back their numbers. So when he's finally mounted up and finally on the horse and like, okay, here they come. And the bugs come over the hill and there is a motherfucking huge swarm of them. And
yeah.
They are designed, the bugs, to move as a swarm. They were all designed the same way. They all had the hook hands. They all were designed to do ground level, overwhelming number attack. They're the Zerg.
Yeah.
You know,
isn't it interesting to note that in this time when we know they're ranged weapons, every one of these beetle drones has been armed with sickles.
They're a weapon of terror.
Yep.
They were a weapon of terror. There's no reason for them to have, they could have all, Aku could have sent in a late 20th century, early 21st century armored division and been a lot more effective against Jack than against bullets. Jack can't dodge bullets.
Uh-huh.
Jack can't hit bullets. There are barely any bullets in the series until you get to the fifth season.
Even if all of them only had a single shot musket on one of their arms, it still would have been more effective than yep. an army of sickle-wielding beetles.
Or just flamethrowers. I mean, we see that work to some decent effect later on.
So clearly, there's this intention that the enemy's going to get chopped up, and they're going to experience this horror as they get killed.
It's a weapon of terror. What happens to a populace that Aku sends all of these little robots into fight? They run screaming in terror. And the robots tear the buildings apart to get to them. And everyone watches yep. their friends getting chopped up. And Aku sits there going, despair.
Yep.
And that's what he lives for. So he probably has, in my opinion, levels of this. You know, things that are going to scare. And mm-hmm. giant bugs with hooks are going to scare a large portion of species. And when he sends these in, he obviously had them sitting around a while. You know, they were already created. Obviously,
right.
he wasn't sending them out to conquer other parts of the planet that we see later that are empty of those people.
And we see the instant he decided in the previous episode, the instant he decided to make a charge on Jack, they instantly set out from the weird tower he lives in. So,
which wasn't terribly far away. It only took them like a day to get there.
Yep.
And Aku sent them out as soon as the lady said, I know who he is. Here's this person, my lord. You should look into this. And Aku tears open the wall and goes,
show me the fool.
Show me the fool who does this. And there's Jack and he's like, huh? Evil grin. Oh, I know where he's going. Yeah. If you saw him with the dogs, he's going out to that place.
Yep.
All right, send the machines. So while Jack and the dogs outpaced them by quite a bit because they were
using
a
rocket
car, yep. So they flew hundreds of miles. And these things moved fast. These things probably moved 60, 70 miles an hour. They were going over all terrain.
We saw them zip past that other dinosaur thing, right?
Right. So they're moving 60, 70 miles an hour over whatever terrain happens to be between the ruins and Hub City. And they were sent immediately. Aku did not waste any time, sent them out immediately. Well, the rocket's dogs get ahead of them and were able to get way high up on top of one of the towers and use their macro binoculars and go, oh mm-hmm. crap, they're closing in. They're however 100 miles away or whatever. They're going to be here in a few hours. We only have a little bit of time. We only got this tiny amount of time by coming here in our rocket car. So when they start setting this stuff up, the bad guys are closing in a reasonable amount of time. Like you can believe that if these things were released, it would take them you know, 6 or 8 hours to cover those few hundred miles to get to the doggy dig.
Well, yeah, we see he starts planning sometime at night, and they don't get there until it's lit. It's well lit out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even morning by the time they get there. So it took them 8 hours. While.
Yeah, yep. A while. But when they do get there, they come over the hill like a surging black wave of death. And that would scare the bejesus out of modern armies. Like, out of anybody even. I don't care if you're flying an attack helicopter. I don't care if you think you're the most badass Marine ever. Seeing a giant wave of giant mechanical beetles with huge scythes on their front arms. Like, that's terrifying for anybody. So the fact that he's able to, like, think clearly through all this also bespeaks well of his training. He didn't flinch.
Right.
This is my challenge. This is what I must overcome.
And isn't it interesting, as we see this whole thing play out, isn't this really more like what he's been trained to do?
Yeah, I would say.
Isn't this more appropriate for his training? A kind of fight that he's actually been trained for. He wasn't trained to deal with a shapeshifter through all those years.
Yeah, how do you practice?
He wasn't
that?
Prepared for a spellcaster. And he had all that preparation, and sure, made him good at cutting, and he was quick to chop Aku down anyways. But was he ever really prepared for magic users? Not really.
Probably not.
But
yeah.
This, oh,
this is both a stand-up fight and a bug hunt.
Yep.
Right here. It would appear to me as if what his father planned to do was, I wish to train my son to be able to marshal armies that can stymie Aku long enough for him to get in there and use the sword.
Yep.
The whole idea behind training Jack to use the sword and not fight Aku, which he never trained him, like you said, to fight Aku. That's now obvious. He was training him to fight and use armies. We want to throw as many humans at this thing as until it slows him down enough that he can get in and use the sword to kill him. Which, I mean, the first episode, Jack did what was the thing for the strike without warning that we were talking about?
Oh, Iaijutsu.
Iaijutsu. Which is like, you know, you stand there looking grim with your hand on your sword, and in a blink of an eye, the sword is drawn and you slash the other bloke's throat.
Actually, yeah. As we see him begin battle, we don't see him use Iaijutsu.
Mm-hmm.
I found that pretty surprising, because the whole martial arts for, you know, a Japanese samurai, you know, the whole kenjutsu theory is you're throwing out attacks. You're here to kill the other fighter.
Pointy end goes in the other man.
So every part of every movement you make in the course of combat has to be dedicated to killing the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Including merely drawing your sword. So in the process of drawing, you will also make a strike. It'll be Iaijutsu, this strike from standing. You
Jack
know?
Did that to Aku. He literally came out of nowhere, and Aku had thought him dead, because he thought he'd eaten everybody. And the Imperial family escaped. Doesn't matter. Still have the Emperor, the only one really capable of wielding the sword.
Right.
The sword disappeared, but that's fine. I don't care where the sword went. The Emperor can't wield it, and I have him in my mind.
Ha ha ha.
Yep. Aku was perfectly fine set up there for a decade or more, just soaking up all that lovely despair. And when Jack comes in, he barely hesitates as well. In the same way his dad did, he came in and was just like, I'm going to find Aku. Where is he? He's here. I'm ready to fight him. No, be careful, Aku. Okay, I will. Boom. Jumps into combat. Less than 10 minutes. Runs across the moat of spirits. Jumps into combat with Aku immediately. He does that strike without warning thing on Aku. Aku has no time to prepare for Jack getting there. Hardly even knows he's there. So, and he almost beat him with it.
Yep.
Almost. And going to the future here, now he's having to fight a much more stand-up army-type fight that all of his training has trained him to do better. So he feels pretty confident in the same way that the Emperor felt confident. I'm going to ride in there with my men. I've won most other times. This will work. And rather than get smacked down by something supernatural, his skills prove more or less adequate.
Right.
You know, he's with the help of his doggy friends and their archaeological tech, manages to set up the world's largest tower defense game.
Yeah.
And thins out these things in these wonderful battle sequences that everyone gushes about, and we are too.
Yeah.
That as they go through each of these checkpoints that he set up in this canyon, mm-hmm. he just completely destroys hundreds of them at a time. And that's like hurling rocks at them at a distance. I mean, each weapon closes closer and closer.
Yep.
So the catapults hit them when they're really far out. And then the catapults were hitting them, and then he mounts the dino horse and charges in against some of them to try to stop them, which has this awesome shovel head, you know, headbutting them, smashing them. And this horse...
It's trampling them, yeah.
Trampling them. This thing is straight out of Skyrim. Like, this horse gives zero fucks. If you attack this horse will fuck you up.
Yeah, this horse is not fucking around, people.
Nope. And every time he's from a position of power on its back, slicing the beetles as they're trying to jump over him and cutting down at them, you know, all of the advantages of mounted combat, you know, that makes somebody on horseback such a difficult factor for a shorter thing.
We also see him use some of the knowledge he gained being trained by the Mongols.
Oh, yeah.
He was riding into combat, and he fires the bows in exactly the same way he was taught, and we saw in that sequence.
Mm-hmm.
He was using that exact same stance.
And he even does the awesome cartoon three-arrow fire at once, and they all hit something naturally.
Yeah, don't ask any questions about how that happened.
Yeah, don't think about trying to target three arrows with one bow. It's just not – don't do it. It's like throwing your sword. You should never do that. So basically with this horse is smashing dozens of these things and we see him losing hit points. Like it's ablative. Like first the horse loses some armor and then he falls off the horse the bug jumps up and knocks him off. And then once he's on the ground, his armor starts getting hit and that starts coming off. This is the same fight his dad had. It is a nice counterpoint to that, really, because his dad was losing, you know, he rode into combat, slashed a coup a few times, then he lost his cloud. Then he lost part of his armor. Then he lost his helmet. Then, you know, like his dad had the same level of, I'm getting fucked up as I'm fighting these things, and it's getting harder and harder and harder as I'm reaching points of exhaustion.
Yep. Actually, so, as we see him progress through that, I wanted to point out that we actually see him sort of transition from using kenjutsu, from using
the two-handed
kendo,
thing. Yeah.
A more traditional Japanese sword style.
That's the one you see on TV with like two hands holding it in front of you. And
he starts to transition into wushu. And we see him use that sort of one-handed as if he's wielding a broadsword style.
Crouching tiger style.
Because
where you're like whipping the sword around.
As he is getting tired, it becomes almost arduous to continue using both hands and guard only with the two-handed stance and everything. So,
but it's blocking. The sword is blocking it. Like, when we get to the point where the robots are attacking him literally all at once, just like Aku did, you know, they're all throwing in. Three or four of them are stabbing down, and he's finding the perfect place to jam the sword between and jam up their attack and block them all at once.
And when we see him in that stance, in the traditional Japanese samurai kendo stance, he doesn't just slip away from the attacks. He guards them. He defends them. And as he switches more to the one-handed or the sort of wushu style, he then tries to slip past the attacks.
Mm-hmm.
He tries to deflect them as he moves past them. Because as he gets tired, it becomes too laborious to continue doing it that very traditional stand-up way.
Robots don't get tired.
Right.
That's another reason that they're a weapon of terror. They just keep coming.
We saw him have to run from the robots for a while once he did get too exhausted with fighting them in that circle.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see him start to run, and he's running at an equal pace without getting tired against the robots. And it reminded me, hey, you know, this guy, he traveled from what was probably Nubia at the time.
This
to Egypt.
This African fellow that had the stamina and endurance of a marathon runner who ran everywhere and taught Jack how to cadence his pace, how to keep his pace normal so he could cover the most amount of ground without taxing himself too much.
So we see the comparison between him running and them running. We see their legs stabbing into the ground and we have that great taiko drum going in the background for it, which those sort of stomping running scenes always go well with the taiko drums in the background, whether it's a horse or an army of beetle robots or just Jack running, honestly.
But and he was along the way, he kept using the traps. He would activate each one of them as he was, like, he shot the controls of the rocket engine of the, what were they?
Oh, the diggers. That was the digger ones. That's how he did that.
Oh, yeah. He was shooting for the catapults.
Honestly,
right.
Those rockets, that was one of the biggest successes. One of the best strategies he had was the rockets. And he probably didn't even realize it, but the pathing program, the pathing AI for those robots is just as bad in this as it is in video games.
Yeah, we're talking original Baldur's Gate here, guys.
He climbs
how bad
up the hill towards the thing. They follow in a straight line up the hill, and then he activates the engine that burns them all.
Yep, tower defense.
And then he goes to the next one, and what do they do? Well, one of them jumps off of the hill and kills itself, and then the rest of them go in a straight line up the hill again and get burned out by the next set of engines.
I have a feeling that Aku probably... I'm thinking he probably got these from the lowest bidder, and once he had contracted them for the AI and pathfinding and whatnot, he stiffed them on the payments and just told them, oh, sue mm-hmm. me. And, you know...
I just thought it was worth noting that... If they had been any more intelligent, the second use of that engine strategy wouldn't have worked.
Yeah, they were not adaptive technology.
So either Jack made a really big, he took a big chance and guessed, or he had learned something about those Beetleborgs, maybe from the dogs, you know, they seem to identify them, destroyer class Aku Beetle droids. Yeah. You know, so maybe they knew something about it and they told him because...
I would think... Yeah, they probably did because they're very intelligent. These dogs are extreme... They're not just talking dogs. They are rich, educated dogs. So they probably knew everything about what they were going to be up against from Aku, what he would likely send. If they were from off planet, which I'm thinking they probably were...
Oh, yeah.
Then they had some a long time to study Aku and see what he did. So if they knew that Aku was going to throw these, and at this level of technology, with this kind of thing that Aku throws, this kind of robot, okay, that's a standard Aku swarm. Like, that's what he does to terrorize. When he chooses to take a new area, he sends in a swarm of, you know, 200 beetles. And when they were finally facing off against them as they were coming through, they would stop. And it looked like they were doing these dramatic pauses. My headcanon, they were downloading new instructions. Like, oh, he just killed over this many percentage of us in this amount of time.
Right.
Download new instructions.
A typical boss fight, it changes strategy after you've killed a certain percentage.
Right, right. And when you get it down to a certain amount of hit, okay, it's dropped below a million hit points. Now it's gonna
start spamming shields and heals. Now we're gonna go down one level and to the right super quickly. You know, it's like Space Invaders. As you get closer and closer to the end, they start speeding up.
The earliest boss battle trigger. Yeah. And when they were doing this, though, they did change their tactics somewhat. They started jumping more.
Yep.
They started trying to undercut him more. They surrounded him instead of moving, you know, or trying to attack him directly. They started trying to get him from all sides at that point instead of rushing through. Their tactics had changed when they lost 90% of what they had from, we're here to kill the dogs. Jack is in our way, to, we have to kill Jack. That's what they were downloading. Yeah. Some poor nerd somewhere in a control center working for Aku, running these things, probably went, what, he just killed off this many? How are dogs killing off this many? I don't know. We'll download another thing. Am I even allowed to use that program? Aku wants it done. Download it. Okay. But what if we're attacking Aku, and what if Aku tells us doesn't want us to attack it? What if this guy kills it and it doesn't kill the dogs like we're supposed to? You can imagine this whole fanfic happening off screen as these guys are weighing between, do I want to be banished to the pit of darkness or the pit of despair?
The pit of hate.
The pit of hate.
Thank you very much.
There we go. Do we want to get eye blasted to the pit of hate, or do we want to try to, you know, use our brains and maybe try to clutch together an algorithm in 10 seconds to beat this guy? Cause he's not attacking us while we're downloading for some reason.
We actually see later in the series, the designers of the Beetle drones.
Oh, we see at least one mad scientist nerd later on. At least one.
I guarantee once we get in, we will see more from the people that made the Beetle drones.
Oh,
so
cool. Okay.
We'll get to talk about those guys more later.
I don't remember that one offhand, but okay. But that's cool. That's why we're doing the rewatch. But when they finally get down to him and they're like, okay, now we're going to try to kill him. Now we're not just trying to get him out of the way. Now we're actually attempting to slice him apart instead of just capture. Because one of them tried to grab him and he like breaks out like super,
we actually
super strong.
See him, or rather them, transition after he does that runaway thing. They all surround him in that big circle, and we sort of, it zooms out and shows the dogs. And it shows what they're seeing from their point of view. And we realize, like, hey, you know, he's killed almost all of them now.
Mm-hmm.
It's down to a manageable number, but he's very tired.
It's a human number now. Yep. Yeah.
So we see him transition to a very, you might call it a little bit more of a wild, stance.
Yeah. He's pissed.
So at this
point. He's angry and tired, and he's had it with these things.
Yep. And it's just these one-handed swings. Really, like, and he's going very quickly, so quickly that we actually see them transition to a sort of slow-mo cam.
That was so good. Oh, yeah, it was beautiful. Elegant shots in this, where he just whips around in this beautiful arc. Yep. And just slices the bug in half. And that sword just goes right through it, and like nothing.
When we get to this point, this is when we see him start to use ki. He starts to shout. He starts to shout with his swings. And it's worth noting that if you're doing kata, or if you're doing your routines, your stances, in a martial arts school, they'll tell you to make a ki with every strike. You know, you'll always go, ha, ha, you know?
Yeah. Well, the whole focus is breath. Breath is life. Life is power.
Well,
you
want
to project. I mean, and it's as important to your brain as it is to the actual, you know, ergs of energy you're putting behind your sword.
Even the word ki is sort of like energy made real.
Japanese onomatopoeia.
It's all about saying, like, you're bringing out power, and you're translating that inner physical power that you have into a verbal communicative weapon on its own.
Almost as if the scream itself could cut them in half.
Right. And it's not just the shout. It's also you want to project a visual effect that's strong. It would intimidate the strongest warrior to see your face when you're in this mode. And we see Jack transition into a face that nobody would fuck with over the course of this slow-mo scene. He lets loose entirely. He's a force of nature that's here to destroy Aku. He becomes, in this moment, nothing more than that. And I think that this is where we start to see that unworthiness in a lot of ways.
He's still young.
That they talk about later in the Guardian episode, which we'll get to. But I do want to examine as we go, what could that Guardian have been talking about? Him not being worthy? When did he make slip-ups that, you know, might have made him seem less worthy than his father? And one of them is this thing where you see throughout this episode, he takes this very personally. This is a battle that isn't so much for the dogs, it's for him.
Yeah, it's a selfish battle. He's lost sight of his goal, which when you're looking at something supernatural like this is really important. If you're following the whole mystical samurai mindset, I guess, the whole idea that I am powerful, I'm using my power for this reason, these people are my clan, I'm defending them. If you lose the purity of that purpose, that's when people say, well, right, you're just as bad as the other person. Well, you kind of do. I mean, it hurts to hurt the other person. You know, the spear in your own back, the spear in their back is the spear in your own back. Like, you're going to become just as bad unless you keep in mind, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing this for a purpose. I can bring myself back from this because the kernel of knowledge in my head is, I don't have to do this.
Right.
I'm doing this because it's the only way I can beat these things. And I'm going to need some therapy later. Like, I don't think there would have been anybody turning to the dark side in Star Wars if they had just had a good therapist.
Yeah.
They could just talk it out and say, I don't. And we even see Aku do that much later.
Oh, yeah. When
he talks to himself about these problems, but because he's the only one he can talk to. But in this case, I got to wonder also, given the supernatural abilities of the sword, they don't get into it a whole lot in the series.
Right. They don't explain it clearly.
Yeah, the sword is not it's a character unto itself in that it's kind of joined to Jack, but maybe there's something built into it of the reason it was made.
Right.
The reason it was made was to destroy evil, single-minded. Like, yes. I mean, even in D&D, like, I mean, this even goes back when I was a kid. Then when they started to get into advanced D&D and stuff, they started giving swords egos, like a named magic sword that you would get in a module or something would have an ego. And the DM would have then a chance to throw some cool shit into the game, you know, like, oh, your sword doesn't think this is a good idea. your sword thinks you're a pussy. You know, your sword really wishes you'd order the decaf.
The guy holding onto me right now is a huge nerd. No, really. He's the worst. Listen, I'll call you back.
It's on its little cell phone, you know, talking to the other swords. But, oh, really? I'm with a hero. He kicks ass. I mean, God, I'm exhausted. He's killing so many bad guys. Oh, jeez. You wouldn't believe how wimpy my...
Hello, is this the armory? I'd like to talk to the claymore. You know, like...
What do you want, son? I'm in the middle of combat. Battle of Culloden's this weekend. I gotta sharpen up for it.
You know, like, my bad Scottish accent. I'm sorry, Scottish listeners. I'm terrible.
But, no, but, like, the sword might possibly, in a way, and this, again, just my headcanon, might be affecting how Jack is seeing things. He's got a weak ego. Jack is well-trained. Jack has a good heart. But his ego, his force of personality, he's not the emperor. He's not that high level. He's what, fifth level? He's competent, very competent by any normal standards. He's not his dad at this point. His dad had decades more of fighting and nobility and leadership of men, understanding the use of power, understanding how and when it should be used, and then how to come back from it, how to be bloodied in combat and knowing that you've just taken maybe hundreds of lives. Every life was a child. Every life was a small boy playing by a brook. Every life was a man who perhaps had children of his own, and you took it. How are you going to reconcile that? Well, they put themselves in opposition to me, and they were going to take away my child by my brook in my house, and I have to take the hit for that so that my son might not have to. That whole idea of that higher idea and understanding of combat his father had to oppose the sword.
Yeah, you're right about
and
that.
And the sword was forged to destroy evil. Only one purpose. Yep. That's it. Pure, clean, efficient destruction. That's all it did. And Jack probably fell prey to that. If that works that way, if that supernatural thing works that way, then poor Jack was sitting there when he got to his weakest. He was the most exhausted, the most hurt, the most, what's the word would be? Maybe not feeling
vulnerable.
Despair. Vulnerable, that's a good word. Yeah. Feeling a little bit like maybe I'm not going to make it, guys. Like I did my best and I still, the dogs are literally right behind me and I still might lose. Only one of those things would have to get through. One.
Yeah, we see them get the rest so of them. Close in the slow-mo scenes. We see them come so close to killing Jack multiple times. And he just cuts them.
Yep.
Just barely coming out ahead. And we see him get covered in their blood, and sort of there's the symbolism we're seeing.
Yeah.
Where he gets covered in blackness and his furious face is all we can see clearly.
Oh, that's that one shot. Like you were saying, like everybody uses for some stuff on YouTube. And it's that shot of that sort of womb of evil where he's in that sort of, it's blackened on the sides, but it's pink in the middle and it's squirting this blackness onto him. And all you see is like a vague form of Jack in his grimace of determination shining through the evil. That's all you can see. But he's surrounded by liquidy blackness, almost evoking Aku himself.
Yep.
Like you were so surrounded by it and so inundated in it. How much of Jack is left? His eyes and his grimace. That's it. And his sword sticking out the bottom, which, you know, metaphorically might be supporting him in that case. But like maybe the sword is driving him to this. The sword is not allowing him to have any higher thought right now. The only thing Jack is thinking about is these dogs are a proxy for my people and my clan and my family. And if they die, you know, over my dead body.
I failed all
of them. And I failed my dad. I failed years of training. Aku wins. No. I will give up my humanity to stop this.
Yep.
Well, you're going to get some dark side points for that, son. you're going to embrace that a little too close.
Yeah. And, you know, we do see that. And they actually go into this in a later episode.
Oh, cool.
Actually, later episodes, they'll talk about this theme of the more Jack becomes a force of nature, the more Jack is just the sword that destroys evil, the more susceptible he comes to being overtaken by Aku mentally. And we'll see that explored multiple ways.
He is the Shogun of Sorrow.
Aku is very blunt.
He said it right out loud. I am the Shogun of Sorrow. And if you swear fealty to the Shogun of Sorrow, you're going to be sad. So he finally manages to ruthlessly slice apart the rest of these things as the bugs have surrounded him. And, you know, he, like you said, he's bloodied. He's covered in this oil or fluid of some sort they were using for operations. You know, he's bare chested, with big barrel, bare chest, like he's been, like, showing off his power that he's that strong. A little something for ladies, or the gay guys, if they like
it. We see him standing on top of that pile of robo corpses at the end.
Yes. I have one. And he's got the badass expression, like Iwo Jima, like he's holding the flag.
Yeah, he's got like, the Sashimi.
I've won.
He's got the Sashimono still, yes, which is just another sign that he's taking this way too personally.
Uh-huh. You just fought robots. They don't give a shit. The only thing it gives a shit is your mind. The dogs just see you killing robots and are astounded that you're able to do this.
And they're happy. And you know, one of them comes up. Oh, my gosh. The Rothschild comes up.
Oh, I say, that was brilliant. Oh, my goodness.
He's so excited. He starts laughing.
Just like a dog would do.
And
now that was smashing! A real bang-up job! Good, Sir Jack. 'Twas truly a noble deed you have done today, and an historic victory most worthy of our logs. You have saved our pack from the wrath of Akku's drones. We are forever indebted to you.
And Jack actually uses Ki-I on him. He's a silent, but he uses that force of presence.
It does that audio stomp. Boom.
Yeah, when he looks at him, it causes Rothschild to fall on his back foot just like it did for a robot. So, like, he's still not out of that mode when Rothschild first addresses him. He's still partly in that mindset of, like, I'm here to kill.
Well, it's like a berserker mode. Like you're so into that mindset. It's hard to kind of get out. It's the zone. Yep. You know, sports people get in the zone and it's just you're focused, and it takes him a second to kind of like relish his victory. Like, I have done it. I have defeated Akku's minion. You defeated a sliver of a fingernail of Akku's minions. You've done nothing, but it does. You've done. The something that you've done wasn't even for you. The something you've done was for these poor dogs.
Although when the dog says thank you, he's like, I didn't do it for you.
Thanks are not necessary. It is my duty to oppose the minions of Akku, and my mission to vanquish the very demon himself.
Jack is not exactly selfless here.
Nope.
He's actually mostly happening because he feels a connection to the torture the dogs had, you know?
Yeah.
He's just using them as a proxy. Although, he did help them. I mean, he is being a good guy.
Well, he says, like, to reflect on that, too, the only line he really says at the end there, when the last robot's trying to run away, he's like, there is no escape.
Oh, yeah.
And he runs up and kills it. Like, of course, there's not going to be... He's still conceptualizing them as organic. Like, he still sees them as an enemy I must defeat. And every enemy he's ever had to defeat has been organic to some degree. But that defeat has rarely meant killing them. This is the first time he's really had to destroy something.
Right.
And he was all in on its destruction. Exactly the way that we were talking about. You know, the Ki-Is, everything about it has to be devoted to putting the pointy end in the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
Which he did repeatedly. When it finally gets him to the end there and he's like, he gets the kudos from the dogs. They're all wagging their tails and saying, we're going to find a way to go back to being nomadic. It'll be harder for Akku to find us. We're going to find the rest of our people. And underneath all that, I think we're going to try to find a way to get off this planet. It's not so important to dig ourselves up while Akku is still here. Like, this is not great. But they know there might be other labor camps with other dogs. And now they have enough people to try to find them and get them out. And Jack walks in and says, that's it. My work here is done. And we pull back and find that Akku has watched the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, but it's important to note exactly what Jack said. He said,
Akku's wrongs must be righted. Surely there is a way to reverse his spell. I will find a way back to my own time. There, I will finish what I started centuries ago and defeat Akku's evil before it was ever truly unleashed.
We zoom out, and obviously, like you said, Akku, he's been watching the whole time. And he's not worried one little bit. What was it he said?
Quest as you may, but we will meet again when I see fit. In a time and place of my choosing. And it is I who shall put an end to the war started in that age-long past. Samurai Jack.
There's not a doubt in his mind he's going to win. And he just watched an entire column of soldiers or warriors, whatever you want to call those drones, get decimated.
And Akku has the same power that, and I've talked about this, I think, on our other podcast, Jumpgate, that an immortal has a very specific kind of superpower that is hard for mortals to wrap their heads around, especially if it's an ageless immortal that's just there all the time with the same consciousness, that's very hard to change how they do things, or they do things for reasons that seem completely, we don't understand why they do what they do, because they're so old. They've already thought through the 10 most common responses. So when they do a thing or not do a thing, it's usually so considered. It's like, you know, a 10-year-old trying to figure out their, you know, watching their father do a business transaction and going, why did you say that to him, Daddy? And why did he say that? And why did he leave angry? You told him something nice. Well, so you would take forever trying to explain it to your 7-year-old. Yep. What an advanced business deal might look like in negotiation, because there's so many layers there between two players who really know their shit, and they know their business, and they know the money involved, and they know the tools they have. So much experience in comparison to that. Even a young vampire, 200-300 years old, going back maybe to the 1600s-1700s, even a vampire there must look at even the most mature, cagey politician going, this person's a child. You know, Aku has been around for thousands of years and has thousands of alien species that he's dealt with and subjected and subjugated. And watching Jack do this little thing is like, of course I'm going to win. I just have to wait him out. I just have to keep trying, as I've always done, new tactics every time to try to beat him. And of course, along the way, we do see a significant number of robots thrown at him, but I don't think they're exactly the same kind of robots.
No, he tries a variety of tricks.
I mean, he might use the beetles again. I think he does around one of the portals.
Yep.
And there's that's just because he happened to have them there, but Aku was there too. So like they were just support crew for him.
Yeah. But actually see the beetles get used a lot doing other tasks and then inadvertently being drawn into the battle just because they were already there.
Well, they are like all terrain. You know, they can climb up walls and shit. They can cut down trees with those skies. They can terrorize people. One or two of them can easily round up a whole bunch of people to bring them to a pit to dig crystals.
Later on, we'll see them used to investigate like unidentified flying objects that land, you know, like, so we'll see like when something lands errantly on the planet without going through the proper channels.
Oh yeah, Aku's all over that shit.
Those beetles show up and surround whatever vehicle it is, and they're basically instructed like, hey, this is your one chance. This is your one chance to make this right. Otherwise, you just landed on Aku's planet.
Whose house? Aku's house. So, towards the end, you know, we watch him walk towards the camera with this awesome, you know, Aku just filling the screen behind him with this awesome, bizarre-looking mouth. And he says, you know, we will meet again, and I will defeat you, Samurai Jack. Ha ha ha. And then Jack walks into the camera, and it goes, wacha, right in his eyes.
Right, like, when he opens his eyes like that, yeah.
That's your key frame. That's your... Okay, we have just established our hero. We have seen what he can do. We have seen his inner turmoil, at least as far as a smoking gun for it. We have seen, you know, our own personal headcanons, maybe, about, like, what that means. Like, what might be making Aku do what he does and make Jack do what he does. We've seen Aku being casually evil to an entire race of beings who showed up. Like, we've pretty much established through this how our characters are going to interact. How Aku was born out of all of this is probably at this point largely forgotten by the audience. Like, how did Aku even get there? Oh, an eclipse.
Yeah.
What eclipse? What? Who is this? What? No, this is why we did Birth of Evil first.
Right.
It lends so much more gravitas to this final, this final statement of purpose from our hero and from our villain at the end of this.
It's great to see the contrast between his father riding in on Sleipnir, and the Samurai Jack, riding in on this weird...
Oh, it's degraded. I mean, if you look at it, his father rode in on Sleipnir versus a supernatural evil of unspeakable darkness. And Jack was riding in on a 6-legged horse, not an 8-legged one, wearing armor including a pot on his head, not celestial armor, fighting off a horde of physical manifestations of wasn't even possessed by Aku.
His father was fighting
possessed armor.
Yep.
And like all of this was not the epic fight his father had. Why? He's not as high as level. He's not a superhero. He's a regular hero right now.
Yep.
Still wielding the awesome blade, but even if you have a Hackmaster +12, if you're still just a first level person, are you really worthy of the Hackmaster? Honestly, is that really going to make your life any better or easier? Are you going to really value the level up that you get from that sword?
Yep.
Unless you have the wisdom to understand what that leveling up means. And these are questions that Jack has to address as he goes along, as we get these nice little interactions with all the panoply of amazing little characters that he meets, you know, the monks and the Scotsman guy and the everybody through the next couple of seasons. I really, really enjoyed how they saved their animation budget in this for the really beautiful shots. The things you watch the slow-mo. Them and it brings you out of this standard cartoon action and you're like, oh, look at that. This is what people grin about when they watch the show. And that was just, that's the sauce. You know, that's the special icing on top of the deep dive we're trying to do.
I remember one of the lead animators, in the interview I saw was talking about how when he did this and many other combat scenes, he wanted martial artists who happened to be watching to sort of, when they saw it, to be like, oh, I know that move, you know, like, I know what he's doing and why he would do it.
As opposed to the jumping around of the Power Rangers or something, which is meant to look athletic and beautiful and evoke this sort of artful fighting style, they're just kind of doing gymnastics. And it looks cool. It does. That's why part of the reason the Power Rangers was popular, for example. But in this case, they made a good choice. Thematically, they made a good choice. We're calling him a samurai. Let's give him some fucking samurai moves.
Yep.
And actual samurai
moves. What was really cool about it, and what we'll see as we go through, these last three episodes establish the three types of episodes that you'll see in Samurai Jack. An exposition story episode.
Mm-hmm.
We see here's a group of allies that Jack can recruit, and then finally a combat focused episode,
or either recruit or a people he's saving, because he does that quite often. Like half of the stories are him saving a people or a little peaceful group of people that's just keeping to themselves. They're under a coup's radar.
But sometimes there are episodes that are pure exposition. We'll just see him traveling to do this one thing, and it tells a story about Jack, or it tells a story about the land he's in, or something.
Or Jack's a part of somebody else's story. Later on, when we get to the Viking guy that's trapped in the volcano thing, that he's pretty much, you know, not to spoil too much, but he's part of that guy's story. Jack facilitates his. That's not Jack's story at all. He's just making his way into a cave, and he finds this. And Jack is the MacGuffin for this guy's story.
Right.
Which, again, happens a couple of times.
What I wanted to say is, you know, we see those episode varieties sort of laid out in the course of these three episodes. And sort of now we know what we can sort of expect. And especially with the combat. So what did we see? We saw Samurai Jack when he's at the top of his game at the beginning of the fight. He starts out with his standard kendo kenjutsu strategy. He is using the normal top to bottom strikes and the basic kata, splitter, you know, the sort of idea that he's basically going through routines that he already knows, he's prepared for. And as soon as somebody falls into one of these positions he knows the strike for, he goes for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then as the battle goes on and he wears out, he has to switch to something a little bit less predictable. And so we see him move to wushu and sort of.
That's the breadth of his training. Yeah. Like this is the advantage his dad didn't have.
And we'll see that in a few other episodes. And I'll point it out when we see it, because you should really compare, or at least we will anyway.
Compare. We're huge nerds, and that's what we're here for.
The episodes and what type of forces and why did they force him to transition the same way? Mm-hmm. At what point does he start using kiai and iai jutsu? You know, what makes him use these different techniques that we know from samurai, and when, what makes him transition away from that to use some of the other training he's had. So I always like to look at that, and this episode sort of establishes that concept, and we'll see it come back again and again.
Cool. I don't believe there's anything else we can really say about this one. It was a very good end of a little trilogy. We don't really see another one of these for, a long time. But maybe not even until season. I think season 5 kind of is like one long episode, as far as people have told me.
Yeah.
So we don't really see this sort of grouping of episodes like that. We see some callbacks every now and then. A beloved character may appear again, but we don't really see, you know, this, then this, then this, and it's one long story.
Oh, yes. It was quite beautiful, especially this last one. We see We see a lot of really just artful shots and beautiful animation.
Mm-hmm.
I quite enjoyed it.
Well, I think we have come to the end of this episode of Backjack. What do we have next time?
The next one is episode 4, Jack and the Woolies.
And the Critcholites. I think that's how you say it.
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's the one where they get the one dude. I think it's the same voice actor that does Mandark.
Oh,
that does the voice of the aliens that have landed. They're all really fucking annoying. Those guys.
We'll probably hear them say their name, and
then we'll know how to say it. But that's coming up next time on Backjack. And thanks for joining us today. My name is Andy,
and I'm Matt,
and we will see you next time, guys.
Thanks for listening.
Bye bye. Got some thoughts about the show you gotta get off your chest? Are we completely wrong, or do you love the podcast with a burning passion? Why not let us know? Contacting Andy and Matt is easy. Find us on Facebook. Email us at backjackpodcast@gmail.com. See our notes and reference links over at backjackblog.wordpress.com. Shoot us a tweet at backjackpodcast. And listen directly at, you guessed it, backjack.podomatic.com. That awesome Samurai Jack music remix that you've heard was done by Musicality Music, and you can check out the rest of his stuff at www.musicalitymusic.net. Backjack the Samurai Jack Rewatch Podcast is a Ninja White Star production.